Welcome to Oncology Today, current and future role of molecular residual disease analysis and its relevance in colorectal cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. John Strickler from Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. During this program, the use of agents and treatments that are not approved may be discussed, so please check out the package inserts for more. To begin, I asked Dr. Strickler to discuss the prognostic value of MRD findings for patients with colorectal cancer.
I think when you line up the MRD tests against clinical pathologic features that we've been trained to use to determine a patient's risk of recurrence, it clearly outperforms those classic clinical pathologic features in these types of observational data set, specifically T stage, T3 versus T4, end stage, and then all of these clinical pathologic risk factors that are in our national guidelines to use to determine whether to give adjuvant chemotherapy for stage 2 disease. Lymphovascular invasion, perineural invasion, nodal harvest, tumor budding, margins. MRD status outperforms all of those features. Now, if you look at our national guidelines, it will say use clinical pathologic features to determine whether to give adjuvant chemotherapy for a patient with stage 2 disease. And yet it doesn't include MRD testing in that, when that's the most prognostic biomarker we have. So I do think that this will eventually enter into not just routine practice, because many of us are using this, but also it will be reflected in our guidelines as well.
Yeah, actually, that was the next thing I was going to ask you about, which is currently what guidelines are from ASCO, from NCCN, from ESMO, up to date. But before you get into that, just to relay some, I get these flashbacks sometime. And as you were talking, I had this flashback to, I don't know whether it was 2003 or 2004. I was at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. Mm-hmm. And in those days, we did these interviews one-on-one. And so I was in some suite at the hotel in San Antonio interviewing Dan Hayes from the University of Michigan. And he said, I want you to find this guy named Soon Paik, who's a pathologist with the NSABP, because he's going to present this thing tomorrow. And, of course, that was the Oncotype. And of course, we followed that along as Oncotype was introduced and came into practice. And in a way, this talk that you just gave and this topic, to me, it brings up some thoughts about what happened with Oncotype. Obviously, it's a very different assay, very different purpose. But in terms of how it was interpreted and brought into practice, I think there's some analogies, and we'll maybe get into that. The biggest one being is that people follow the data, mm-hmm. but we can get into that, and we'll get into where the data is right now and where you see it heading. But could you summarize right now, because I think maybe there's a little bit of a disparity between what you see in the guidelines, or at least what I see in community-based practice, and I'm curious what your thoughts are. But can you summarize right now what these various entities say about this approach?
Yeah, I think it's important to acknowledge that MRD testing is currently not recommended in the practice guidelines that are published by NCCN. I don't have the ASCO guidelines at the tip of my fingers at the moment either.
That's because there aren't any.
Yes. Historically, every guidelines committee has its personality, right? And historically, the colon and rectal cancer guidelines committee tends to be on the cautious side, which has its pluses and minuses. The current guidelines do acknowledge, and what I mean by the guidelines, the NCCN guidelines do acknowledge that this tumor-informed MRD test is a strongly prognostic assay. So there's no question about that. I think where there is some concern in the guidelines is how to incorporate that into our practice. And there is some concern that we will be withholding adjuvant chemotherapy for patients based on this result when that has not been prospectively validated. Now, that work is ongoing. But the challenge that we have in a real-world context, and this is something I have discussed it with members of that committee, who are actually ordering this test, by the way, for their own practice, right? So The challenge we've got is that the real world practice of medicine is far more complicated than any trial. And there are many times where we're on the fence about adjuvant chemotherapy. It could be somebody with T3N0 disease, stage 2A colon cancer, where there's not a medical indication for adjuvant chemotherapy, but maybe they're young and they're wanting to be aggressive. Could you use that as a tiebreaker? There may be a case of maybe an elderly patient with higher risk stage 3 disease, where you're wanting to spare that person the toxicity of maybe an oxaliplatin doublet. Could you potentially use that to maybe make your adjuvant chemotherapy match that patient's individualized risk? And I think the answer is yes. I think in the real world practice, which is so much the art of medicine, not the science, that we need to have these types of tools at our disposal to more precisely individualize the care of our patients, because not all patients would qualify for all of these trials.
So again, Oncotype analogy, again, in the beginning, and even right now, you said you think a lot of the people on the committee are using it, but at least when I poll investigators, they don't necessarily, or if I ask them, they'll go through the same kind of thinking or logic about, well, we don't have the data, et cetera. And that, again, that was true with Oncotype. And then we would put up a case and say in a meeting, and we would say, would you order an Oncotype in the patient? And most of the audience would say no. And then we would say, well, the surgeon ordered an Oncotype and it shows this, and then they change their answer. So, you know, I don't know whether the same, you know, you get people referred in who've had MRD assays and, you know, well, you might not have ordered it, but you have to deal with it. So, and also it gets into, you know, we do these surveys of investigators and docs in practice. We call it going beyond the guidelines because we don't ask what the evidence is. We ask, what do you do in your practice? So that was my next question is, outside a clinical trial right now, are you using, in what situations are you using MRD? Let's start out with the adjuvant setting. We'll get into other settings as well. But in what situations are you using it? Another analogy to Oncotype that came out early was, is it going to make a difference? If you present it to the, is the patient going to turn down chemo no matter what you say? So just don't bother if that's the case. But anyhow, just generally speaking, how do you kind of think it through outside a trial setting right now?
Well, understanding that this is not in our guidelines, I think it's important to have a discussion with the patient and talk about what we know about the test, its strengths and its limitations. And I hope with my presentation, I've presented in a balanced way that no test is perfect. And this test is not perfect either, but it has some strengths to it. So I have a discussion with the patient about what we could learn. And then I say to the patient, okay, if we have a plan for what we'll do with a negative result versus a positive result, that's a good reason to do this. Now, not every patient wants to know these things, doesn't want to know about the risk of recurrence 6 months in advance. But many patients actually do, and they want to be part of that decision. Now, where do I like the test the best? And where would I kind of provide that patient some guidance that a test could be useful? I think that case of a stage 2 patient, particularly a 2A patient, maybe they've got no high-risk features, or maybe they've got one high-risk feature like lymphovascular invasion, which confers a slightly higher risk. There, I'm on the fence about adjuvant chemotherapy. I think that's that's somewhat validated out of Dynamic, right? That data I showed you. Additionally, I have found it useful in other scenarios. A classic scenario is patients have metastatic disease that's resected, and there we have very limited evidence that adjuvant chemotherapy helps a patient with a resected metastatic lesion. But data I have not shown, just out of the interest in time, suggests that adjuvant chemotherapy could be of use for patients who remain positive after resection of a metastatic lesion. And maybe we could be a little bit more cautious if it's negative after surgery. We also are plagued by the CEA test, which has been around for decades. And we as clinicians all know that it's oftentimes positive when the patient doesn't have cancer and negative when they do. And that can be very stressful for patients. So sometimes when you're concerned you've got a false positive CEA and you're worried about overscanning a patient, you can use that to reassure the patient that that CEA of 5.2 that's been in between 5 to 6 for the last 3 years, it's okay. It's a false positive. There have also been scenarios, elderly patients, where we're looking to de-escalate treatment. Maybe we're worried they can't handle chemo. And I've also had cases of patients who, for whatever reason, have had horrible toxicity from the CAPOX regimen, and we're looking to make a modification or a switch to FOLFOX or maybe go to a little lighter regimen. It's been nice to kind of match your decision-making to that patient's risk. So I can't encapsulate all the scenarios, but it's a long list of scenarios where I've used it.
Yeah, and again, in stage three disease, I hear people not only who may be borderline for tolerating it, but people who walk in saying, I don't want chemotherapy unless I absolutely need it, and maybe seeing an MRD assay would be helpful. Also, your stage four NED situation, which I was going to ask you about, very common with liver-only mets. They get resected, you know, in that scenario. It looks like it could be helpful. Another thing I wanted to bring up to you is, and again, sorry to bring up breast cancer, but the only example I can think about, at the ASCO meeting this summer and the plenary session was a breast cancer trial called the SERENA-6 study, where they were looking for ESR1 mutations in patients who'd gotten first-line therapy. And either, you know, the control group was just continued to be followed, the other group was switched to another therapy, and the discussant referred to the presence of ESR1 as molecular progression. And I was thinking, you know, I know it's a new mutation, but it's not necessarily meaning there's more tumor there. Have you heard this term molecular progression before? And do you think that's what we're looking at here with MRD? And as just so curious, you think it applies to the development of genetic change? You see this with BTK inhibitors also in CLL, they get mutations. You consider that, quote, molecular progression?
You know, I watched that presentation at the plenary. I'm not a breast oncologist, but I watched it with interest. In my mind, that's a different question. It's the same technology in some ways, but a different question. Meaning you could have a scenario where a patient's ctDNA levels are decreasing, but an ESR1 mutation is emerging, right? Potentially that seed of resistance. So, you know, it's essentially an interception strategy for a subclone, maybe that's emerging in resistant setting, versus an MRD where you're actually just trying to capture a growth of tumor volume overall. So in my mind, same technology, slightly different application. And I don't know how to reconcile that here in the context of this discussion. I think the jury's out from that plenary. I thought the discussant did a wonderful job of kind of encapsulating the issues with intercepting a resistant clone early. You know, as a non-breast oncologist, I think it was a great discussion. You know, can we alter the long-term outcomes for a patient by early interception of resistant clone? I think it raised a lot of important questions that we'll need to follow up in our world as well in GI medical oncology.
Another thing that you brought up I thought was really interesting, and you mentioned the idea of if you see MRD positivity, particularly to focus imaging-wise on the liver, was the fact that you see it much more commonly in the liver. Do you think it's, and particularly compared to the lung, and like every now and then I hear things about lung mets being different. I don't know exactly why. But do you think this is just, you know, a question of you know, there are less lung mets in general, or do you think there's something about lung metastases biologically that's different than liver mets?
Yeah, so great question. And we don't know the scientific answer, right? But I can tell you as a clinician who sees a lot of colorectal cancer that when patients have disease that selects for the lung, it tends to be indolent disease, it tends to be more responsive disease. And there's also evidence that immunotherapy is far more active for patients who have, say, lung-only disease. So if you're going to have a test that misses one part of the body, let it be the lung, right? Because we know we can pick those up in the lung. We know they're pretty easy to treat, both surgically and with systemic therapy, now potentially with immune therapy as well, though that work is ongoing. Liver metastases are the bane of our clinic, right? Because they're tough to find, they tend to be more aggressive, tend to confer worse prognosis. So in some ways, it's well aligned. I do think there is probably a soil issue in that that is less favorable soil for metastasis to develop. And additionally, it appears that biologically it's less aggressive.
Incidentally, getting back to your own non-protocol practice, so when you have a patient you're sending for surgery for liver mets, do you look at MRD and deciding what to do post-op?
Yes, I do. And actually, what I really like, if I had my druthers and I could, I would get the test before they go to surgery than after, because then you're showing the clearance. As I showed you in that data, it's very rare for someone with an active liver metastasis to have ctDNA-negative disease, right? So, you know, you'd love to see they're positive before, they get the intervention, they turn negative, and now there's some developing data that indicates that you may not be providing that patient much in the way of benefit if you give them adjuvant chemotherapy and they're ctDNA negative after surgery.
So another arena I was curious what your thoughts are about is delayed progression or metastatic disease. And specifically, I feel like I think I've heard about, I'm not sure, I don't think there's actually an FDA indication for Signatera, or I'm not sure it's a classic indication, but in any event, I've seen the issue brought up of duration of IO therapy, for example, with patients who are MSI-high disease. They get 2 years of an IO, they have a complete response. They're trying to decide at 2 years or whenever it might be a year whether to stop or not. Do you think that is a logical place to use that? I mean, do you see the presence delayed? I was also thinking about breast cancer. We can see delayed metastatic disease 5 years later. Any potential role for MRD in these delayed scenarios?
Yes. So in my laundry list of scenarios where I like to use MRD, immunotherapy for MSI-high disease is right there. We now have some data that's been published, and then our clinical experience has been very favorable with respect to the tumor-informed test for patients who are treated with immune therapy. One of the challenges we have is that frequently when you treat somebody with MSI-high disease who, say, has liver metastases, those lesions will still be radiologically apparent on a scan. So I know years ago we used to just send those patients to the OR and resect those lesions, and then the surgeon would say that was just a mucinous, you know, deposit. That tumor was it was not viable malignancy any longer. So now we're increasingly using the ctDNA to verify that what we see clinically, normalization of CEA, patients no longer symptomatic, the scan pretty much looks better, but that we can kind of verify that in an orthogonal way with another test to ensure that we can stop immunotherapy after, say, 1 to 2 years, right? I know many patients think also that they should go beyond 2 years with immune therapy. It's not our practice to do it, certainly not if they're negative.
Well, also, and we actually showed a video of a general medical oncologist who had a – I was all excited because I finally found somebody – who'd given dostarlimab to a patient with localized rectal cancer. But as it turned out, at least on imaging, they did not have a complete response, and the doc wanted to know what to do. And again, this issue of MRD in that scenario came up. And now I'm hearing more and more about using IOs, maybe even instead of surgery, not just in rectal, but maybe in colon. I've heard it in gastroesophageal. Absolutely. Again, do you see the day coming where you find out, you find localized MSI-high disease, you give IOs, and you check their MRD and see if they're cleared and decide whether or not to not go to surgery?
Yes. So we're already doing this at our institution. I know at a lot of other institutions. It's the so-called watchful waiting or active surveillance approach, where patients are treated with some type of definitive therapy. Could be immunotherapy for MSI-high disease, could be definitive for a rectal cancer. It could be a total neoadjuvant approach with chemoradiation and chemo, where you're trying to avoid that aggressive surgery. And we will add the MRD test in. There's one caveat I will say, and that is for patients who have localized disease, occasionally all you've got is an FNA specimen. And that sometimes can be difficult to build a personalized assay out of that. So that can be a limiting factor. something to be aware of. The other issue just to be mindful of is that while the tumor-informed tests are quite exquisitely sensitive for, say, nodal and liver disease, they're not quite as sensitive for local recurrences. So I would not put all my eggs in that basket. You can't stop your other surveillance tools, but it can be incorporated in that, and that is our institutional approach.
And, you know, for all of these things, you know, always we always bring up the issue of patient involvement if they want to be involved in the decision, and they can often have a say in these situations where it's not really clear what to do. Another slide that really struck me, because I'm always asking people, what about other tumor-informed assays? I mean, when I ask investigators that are looking at this issue, and I never hear very much, and then you put up this slide, and there's like seven or eight other tumor-informed assays that are being studied. And I'm curious where these things stand and also where you see things heading, both tumor-informed, not tumor-informed, over the next, let's say, 3 to 5 years. Again, using the Oncotype example, what we saw there was, you know, there were so many other assays. There's MammaPrint, there's all these other assays out there in breast cancer. But today, now you, when you look into practice, people are mainly using Oncotype. And the reason really is they had the data. You know, they hooked up with the NSABP and other groups, and they just had a ton more data than anybody else did. And kind of that looks the way things are right now with Signatera. Do you see that continuing or maybe changing in the future?
You're absolutely correct. There are a couple of factors that will distinguish tests from one another for us. Until we have the day where there's truly what we call a bake-off, right, where we're comparing these assays head-to-head with like simultaneously collected specimens, that's obviously a very challenging thing to execute, and I'm not optimistic we'll have that data. We have to rely on cross-trial comparisons, real-world experience. So there are a few factors that will make these tests stand out versus one another. One is sensitivity, right? Does it detect cancer when it's there? Now, you can see various technologies coming out, and the thought is if you introduce more variants into that personalized assay, you could potentially raise the sensitivity. But we need to make sure that as we raise the sensitivity, we don't get false positives, right? And I think that's the flip side of that sensitivity. The other aspect is speed, right? If we are trying to make a decision about adjuvant chemotherapy, we've got a window to do it. We can't wait 2 months for a result. It's got to come back in a time frame where we can actually incorporate that into our decision and make an informed decision so that we're not missing a window. And then there's the third issue, which, you know, we don't talk a lot about, but for all of us in the clinic, know this is a huge issue. And that is, what's the experience? What's the logistics of ordering it? What's the billing experience for the patient? How taxing is it on our staff? How easy is it for the patient to go get a blood collection from, say, maybe a home nurse? These are also factors that play a huge part of how willing we are to adopt a new technology in the clinic. The more favorable the experience for the patient and for our clinic staff and for us as clinicians, the more likely we are to work with that particular vendor as well.
I guess you could add cost to the issue, but that's always hard to play out, and a lot of times doesn't make right. that much of a difference. You know, I was thinking in general in oncology, this idea of following the data is so predominant when you look at all different tumor types. The example I always think about is lung cancer, where all the IO trials were with Pembro, and that's what everybody uses for metastatic disease. But it just, for some reason, the trial in locally advanced disease in lung, durvalumab looked better. And so now that was, again, indirectly compared to Pembro, but now everybody uses durvalumab because that's where the data is. Yeah. So one other thing I wanted to ask you about before we get into your cases, I've always found really fascinating the issue of, you know, lifestyle, exercise, and of course, always, aspirin, and you mentioned the celecoxib studies. There have been a lot of cool studies. People from Dana-Farber and others have looked at that. I've always thought that was very cool, although it doesn't seem like it came much into practice. And I was really stunned when I saw that celecoxib data. Mm-hmm. Can you just sort of briefly encapsulate that again And talk about why you think this is. Is it just a question of, you know, picking it up, or is there something specific about this assay that's picking something up that relates to this pathway?
Well, yeah, there were two separate kind of aspirin celecoxib studies I showed. The first was a large retrospective analysis, post hoc analysis from this CALGB study from Dr. Meyerhart and his colleagues. Now, the first question is, could celecoxib potentially reduce the risk of recurrence? And in the overall population of the 2,500 randomized patients, celecoxib did not improve outcomes overall. But there was a little hint of activity. I think the hazard ratio in the published paper was around 0.88. It suggests that maybe there was a subgroup of patients that benefited. They then went back, found 1,000 out of the 2,500 patients had blood and tissue collected after surgery, and they were able to run that Signatera tumor-informed test on those 1,000 patients, and then looked at how celecoxib performed in the positives versus the negatives. And for reasons that are not clear to me or anyone else, in this post-hoc analysis, celecoxib use in the adjuvant setting provided a disease-free survival benefit and an overall survival benefit, but only in those patients who were positive. Now, the whole theory here is, well, if you have a PI3 kinase alteration, that's where celecoxib is going to be at its best. It's a COX-2 inhibitor. It's a selective COX-2 inhibitor. Of course, aspirin is a non-selective, but it's really acting on that PI3 kinase pathway. So if maybe you isolated those patients with PI3 kinase pathway mutations, maybe it was driven by that group. That same group of investigators went back and looked at whether the benefit held up in patients with PIK3CA wild-type disease, and in fact, it did. Celecoxib provided a benefit not just for the PI3 kinase mutants, but also for the wild-types. So I can't explain it scientifically why celecoxib is only beneficial for the ctDNA positives, but it clearly was in this paper. Now, the other part of it is, of course, Alaska. Alaska trial was very different. That did not look at MRD at all. That just sequenced the tumors after surgery, independent of MRD status, and only gave aspirin to people with PI3 kinase pathway alterations. And that was a very compelling and strong signal in favor of 2 baby aspirin a day for 3 years. But remember, that was biomarker selected based on a PI3 kinase pathway alteration.
So I guess I'm the last one to know that the potential mechanism of aspirin and celecoxib through the PI3 kinase pathway, I never heard that before. And of course, we hear about PIK3 inhibitors all the time. Breast cancer, maybe prostate cancer, capivasertib, alpelisib. Like, how would you compare what these PIK3 inhibitors or AKT inhibitors are doing compared to what aspirin and celecoxib are doing?
Well, they're both modulating the pathway, right? You know, the challenging part for us is we've never really seen much in the way of activity for the PIK3CA, those PI3 kinase inhibitors right. In colorectal cancer. And yet, this was a large study, a retrospective observational study published in New England Journal in 2011, found that people in an observational data set did much better with aspirin than not. And then that was validated out of Alaska, out of this Alaska trial. It's a good question, and I do wonder the same. Could the patients get a similar level of benefit from, say, alpelisib? To my knowledge, it hasn't been looked at, but certainly this would support looking at a more specific PI3 kinase inhibitor.
So again, curious about your own practice. Do you bring up the issue of celecoxib or aspirin to your patients?
So starting first with the ctDNA positive patients, when I get a positive result, I'm repeating the test. I'm scanning that patient, starting with that liver MRI, going to a PET, and I'm telling them, you can take aspirin. There's some post-hoc studies that suggest that could be of benefit to you. I personally prefer aspirin over celecoxib just because it's something I'm more familiar with. But for me, it's the risk-benefit favors giving aspirin to those positives. But additionally, beyond that, all patients now with resected stage 1-3 colon and rectal cancer, I am ordering an NGS test looking for one of those PI3 kinase pathway mutations, and it is in our NCCN guidelines as well. Thankfully, I've not gotten pushback from insurance for those tests, And I am recommending that patients, as part of their survivorship plan, take 2 baby aspirin a day for 3 years if they have one of those PI3 kinase pathway alterations, independent of MRD status.
Fascinating. All right, let's get into some of your cases here. You have a 58-year-old man. What happened with him?
So this is an actual case from my clinic. This is a 58-year-old who was referred for colonoscopy. He saw the ad on television and submitted his sample, and it came back positive. So he got a colonoscopy. They found what was initially thought to be an adenoma, went for extended right colectomy, had a classic low-risk T3N0 stage 2A colon cancer, moderately differentiated, no LVI, no perineural invasion, margins were clear, no obstruction, no perforation, everything looked great. 37 lymph nodes were negative, proficient mismatch repair. His CEA was 31 before surgery, very high. It normalized after surgery. CT scan was great. And we discussed the evidence, and the standard of care for a patient like this is no adjuvant chemotherapy. So we had a discussion about whether he wanted to do MRD testing. I explained to him the role for it for people like himself, explained that it's not necessarily in our guidelines, but for patients like him, could potentially detect recurrence where these standard tests don't. We did have time, so we got the tumor-informed test. Now, the first test was negative, which was great. CT scan was clear. CEA stayed normal. But then, you know, within that six-month time frame from completion of surgery, the test turned positive. So we got an MRI of the liver, and it picked up a tiny liver metastasis that was invisible on CT scan. And interestingly, when we brought him back after that MRI, the CEA surged up to 30. So he was referred for surgery. We resected it, clear margins, and then checked the ctDNA after surgery, and he was negative, and the CEA went back to normal. Now, this patient, healthy, young, fit, was very concerned about his risk of recurrence, and although there's no evidence that this would change his outcomes, he really wanted to go for chemotherapy, so he took adjuvant CAPOX, and the ctDNA remained negative for the next year. But then something happened. A year after his resection of his liver metastasis, my radiologists are calling out a soft tissue nodule in the right upper quadrant of the duodenum that they say looks like recurrent disease. Meanwhile, ctDNA is negative. So we got a PET CT, and you can see by the language here that this is not reassuring language from a PET CT. They saw the soft tissue nodule, and it had increased FDG avidity, concerning for local recurrence, and even pointed out to me as a clinician that mucinous tumors may have low FDG uptake. So ctDNA is negative, PET is positive. Which one should we believe? Well, we decided just to not take any chance, and we had it resected, and it came back as just a low-grade spindle cell lesion. It wasn't cancer. So the patient has maintained a ctDNA surveillance and has remained clear on scans. CEAs remain normal, and he's doing great.
So I think this case is the poster child for colorectal cancer 2025. Really amazing. Can you imagine presenting this case 5 years ago? It would seem like science fiction. I am curious. It was interesting. This patient was picked up with the Cologuard test. I'm curious. I assume that was what the test was that they had.
Yep.
I'm curious what degree of penetration. And incidentally, I think that's being done by the same people who do Oncotype also.
Yes.
At least currently, but which I thought was interesting. But right now, what kind of penetration is there for Cologuard? Are you seeing a lot of patients like this who are picked up that way, or is it just sort of getting started?
Well, so understanding that my clinic is only for patients who've been diagnosed with colon cancer, right? So yes, in my clinic, I have seen a lot of patients that had their initial detection through that Cologuard test. I think that there are operational challenges with the Cologuard test, which the primary care physicians will point out. But we have to acknowledge that we live in an imperfect system, and access to colonoscopies, for various reasons, is not easy. You need a referral from a primary care physician to get your colonoscopy. Not everybody has a primary care physician. If you're asymptomatic, the wait for a colonoscopy, a routine surveillance colonoscopy, can be up to a year. Right. So for a 58-year-old male, I think it's a great tool to ensure that, hey, if I've got cancer, I need to know if I'm high risk or not to go in and get that colonoscopy.
Let's hear about this 48-year-old woman.
All right. Well, if you thought the last one was, reflects modern practice, it's about to get even more complicated. So this is a 48-year-old female who walked into the emergency room with abdominal pain and hematochezia. She got an emergent colonoscopy, which showed a partially obstructing mass in the sigmoid colon. It was confirmed as adenocarcinoma. This was at an outside hospital. CT scan showed a 1.1 centimeter lesion in the right hepatic lobe. That was very worrisome. So she comes to our clinic. We get an MRI of the abdomen to better characterize that. And it's called out as a rim-enhancing lesion concerning for metastatic disease. But they specifically say in the report that it is not easy to biopsy. So I had her see our surgical oncologist, who also agreed with active surveillance given that small size and inaccessible location. She goes on and gets the primary resected. It comes out as a pretty large invasive tumor. So it's invading into the adjacent abdominal wall. It's perforated into the abdominal wall. The margins are clear. There are no lymph nodes involved, but they do point out that it's a T4BN0 microsatellite instability high, MSI high deficient mismatch repair tumor. CEA was slightly elevated before surgery, goes to normal after surgery. So the question we had in front of us is, this patient, younger woman, MSI high, T4BN0 disease, should we give adjuvant chemotherapy or not? And how do we incorporate MRD into this? So of course, the first thing I do is I send her to the genetic counseling, and she does have Lynch syndrome. And she elected to wait for an MRD test result before making a decision. The first result was negative, so she said, I'm just going to take my chances and not do adjuvant chemotherapy, which I supported. We also continued to follow that liver lesion, and it didn't really do anything, didn't grow. 3 months later, the liver lesion is actually decreasing in size, but then 9 months after the colon resection, the MRD test turns positive. So then the question is what to do next. The first thing she said is, let's repeat this test. I don't believe it. We repeat it and the number actually goes higher. I tell her, I don't know exactly where this cancer is coming from, but let's start the standard of care at the time, pembrolizumab. And we were following her ctDNA levels, and it fell from 0.38 down to 0.05 on the tumor-informed assay, but did not clear. So we get a colonoscopy that was already scheduled, and it showed multiple polyps throughout the colon expected for somebody with Lynch, but they also saw a malignant tumor essentially at the anastomosis, biopsy-confirmed invasive adenocarcinoma. And CT scan also performed at that time showed radiographic signs of local recurrence at the anastomosis. So she goes on to get a total colectomy. They resect that anastomotic recurrence, and this one is node positive now, 1 out of 28 lymph nodes positive. And remember, this is after 2 months of pembrolizumab, and there's viable cancer here. But the postoperative ctDNA is now negative. So now we're talking about, now do we give chemo? Or what do we do with that pembro? Our initial plan was to give CAPOX because it was not clear to me whether this was immunotherapy-resistant disease. She declined the adjuvant CAPOX because she was uncomfortable with it with some pre-existing neuropathy. And she agreed to continue 1 year of pembrolizumab. Her MRD was negative after surgery and has not turned positive now 2 years after that surgery for recurrent disease. And she is living her life.
You're right. Another incredible case. And I hear cases like this from docs in practice all the time, you know. And one of the things about this case that was interesting that I've heard from docs in practice that I wonder about is something you actually were commenting on in this case, which is the level, the quantitative level of MRD. You were talking about it going down, et cetera. I mean, is it reliable enough that you can look at the actual level?
Yeah. So once again, didn't show all of this data just out of the interest of time. We know that absolute level is also strongly prognostic. So if you take a group of 100 positives, right, and bucket them into quartiles, those patients with the highest ctDNA levels, what we call mean tumor molecules per mil, have by far the worst long-term outcomes, disease-free survival and overall survival, as compared to those patients who have the lowest level of a positive result. So that's one thing. We know the absolute number really matters, but we also know that change matters. Specifically, we like to see the result that shedding go down. That's a sign of an active treatment. But really what we're going for is clearance, right? We need to convert a positive to a negative. We know a number that's going down is a good thing for a patient. It speaks to an active therapy. But without that clearance, we know that that disease is still viable.
So I was just flashing also on the fact, I think it's in myeloma, that the FDA recently agreed that MRD, which different situation, obviously, but now minimal residual disease assay that's done in myeloma could be a primary endpoint in clinical trials of myeloma. It seems so, you know, predictive of benefit. And a lot of the trials now are, almost all the trials actually are including MRD, a lot of them as actual endpoints. Do you foresee a day when MRD and solid tumors, these type of tumor form assays, will be primary outcomes of clinical trials?
Yeah, absolutely. It's inevitable. We know that patients who have a positive result have an exceptionally poor prognosis, that they have viable disease. And you can imagine a scenario where an unmet need could be filled by an investigational therapy that could potentially clear that circling tumor DNA out. It's an objective marker of response. And the conventional treatments we have outside of locally directed therapies, resection, are to this point not very active. Things like intensified chemotherapy. So if we had a powerful immunotherapy strategy, a vaccine strategy, a novel mechanism of action that can clear that circling tumor DNA out, I think it's inevitable that that could be something that registers a drug for our patients.
So this has really been a great session. I've learned so much. Just a few sort of related questions that kind of popped into my mind as we went along. One is, as always, so many times when I ask investigators to present cases, they end up being young people. I know in general, I think you have maybe a little bit younger population than people in community, but also, obviously, we're seeing a huge increase in the number of young people with colorectal cancer and other cancers. I always like to run by people if they have any pet theories, people bring up the microbiome, et cetera, any theories about what's going on here?
Well, it may not just be one thing. It may be many things that are conspiring to raise the incidence of colorectal cancer. If you look at the actual numbers, for patients under 50, the incidence of colorectal cancer has doubled between 1990 and now. So it is a true public health crisis. We need to figure this out. We know that there are theories about microbiome being important. We know that we live in a hypersterile environment now compared to 100 years ago, and the antibiotics are more powerful. So that's one theory. We know there's been some dietary changes as well over the last few generations that could impact things. We know we're ingesting huge amounts of plastic that humans were not ingesting years ago. And then finally, it may be not something that we're getting. It may be something we're not getting. Specifically, if you think about how human beings lived 100 years ago versus today, the amount of antigens and environmental kind of stimuli pathogens we're exposed to is much lower. So that may be part of the mixture as well.
Now that I think about it, are we seeing an increase in older people with colorectal, or is it just younger?
Strictly younger. So it's something going on in terms of, and it's not genetic either.
Fascinating. So a couple of papers, series of papers I was just curious about. I was looking through your work, huge amount of work you're doing right now. Ultrasensitive tumor-informed ctDNA profiling in pembrolizumab-treated esophagogastric patients predicts clinical response. I saw a number of things related to that. What's that about?
Yeah, so we were fortunate enough to run a study of frontline CAPOX with pembrolizumab years ago, and we went back and validated a hypersensitive tumor-informed test to see how it performed in this group of patients, and was it did exceed expectations. And this was one of these tests that has, you know, over 1,000 different variants it detects. We didn't see any false positives. But once again, it's showing that these tests are getting better, the technology is improving. And so even those negatives that we worry about, I suspect as these tests continue to upgrade themselves, we may see version 2.0 or 3.0 really heighten that sensitivity.
So another thing I saw that you're working on, and I feel like we talk about antibody drug conjugates all the time, and I see it looks like you're doing some work on a MET, or at least one ADC that's MET. Can you talk a little bit about that? And also ADCs in colorectal cancer, I'm kind of wondering why there aren't more of them.
We haven't spoken about antibody drug conjugates, but we should. Antibody drug conjugates have not traditionally been developed for colorectal cancer. There are some reasons for that. The traditional payloads, emtansine, MMAE, MMAF, they don't have a mechanism of action that's well-suited to colorectal cancer tumors. What we've found in recent years is that if you put the right payload onto an antibody, that antibody drug conjugate, specifically, for example, a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor, trastuzumab deruxtecan, is very active in colorectal cancer, right? So we now have new antibody drug conjugates coming in that more that have payloads that are a bit more active against this tumor type. Talusotuzumab deruxtecan, or TMAB-A, is AVI-400. That's an anti-c-MET antibody drug conjugate. It uses that topoisomerase 1 inhibitor payload. Appears to be very active for this cancer. There will be data presented at some upcoming conferences that further expand on this, but it appears that they are driving responses in heavily refractory patients, who, particularly those patients who have higher levels of c-MET expression.
And this is, again, expression amplification or mutation?
So that's the important thing. All it requires is expression, meaning just there's greater cell surface receptor expression. It does not require amplification. Amplification of the gene, of MET gene, is pretty rare in colorectal cancer. So it's a larger group of patients that has c-MET overexpression. The other really fascinating thing about c-MET is that expression tends to increase with each subsequent line of therapy, particularly after patients are exposed to targeted therapies, whether it be an EGFR antibody, things like sotorasib, or anti-KRAS G12C therapies like adagrasib, things like tucatinib, trastuzumab will drive up c-MET expression because c-MET will be part of that mechanism of acquired resistance. So it's a perfect 1-2 punch to kind of follow behind and target that dependency.
Any other of the rux, again, there's data, is TROP2 expressed in colorectal? We see that in lung and breast cancer.
Yeah, it's been a little less developed for colorectal cancer. I haven't seen that data or worked with that drug for colorectal cancer. It may be that we haven't yet found that right payload with the right antibody, or it may not be as heavily expressed, but it's something that certainly is worth investigating.
So, you know, we've got ESMO coming up next month, and then ASCO GI and the ASCO meeting next year. I'm curious, what are some of the ongoing trials right now that you're looking forward to see reported over the next year?
Well, I am anxiously waiting for that Circulate US study to come out. You know, we covered that earlier. I mean, this is such an important study to validate prospectively what to do with a negative versus a positive result. I don't know when that will come out. Could be a while, but I would love to see that data. The other very intriguing area of drug investigation for colorectal cancer is to find groups of patients with microsatellite stable colorectal cancer who may still benefit from immune therapy. And we may be seeing some interesting data coming out in the near future about whether you could potentially pick out patients who have, say, non-liver metastatic disease who might be sensitive to an immunotherapy strategy, either alone or together with, say, an anti-VEGF tyrosine kinase inhibitor. So, we are anxiously awaiting some data to come out suggesting that these patients may benefit.
which TKI and IO? I know there was a lot of excitement some years back with nivolumab and regorafenib.
Yes.
What's the new kid on the block, so to speak?
Well, we are expecting to see data from zanzalintinib with atezo in patients with microsatellite stable colorectal cancer. That was a positive result, top-line result from a press release, but the data will likely be presented at ESMO, so we'll stay tuned for that. I would really love to see, is that benefit really focused on those patients with non-liver metastatic disease, or could somebody with, say, a liver metastasis still benefit? So that's probably the most immediate data we're looking forward to seeing.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Strickler, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.